Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 29, Episode 13. Coming up on the show, we've got the space shuttle set up, the carnal visitations of a dead pharaoh, and abductee counterintelligence and the Carter Affair. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
I love it that I'm going to do a show on very, very complicated and sometimes distressing stories about military alien abductions and their connections, and yet you're going to do a story about carnal knowledge of a pharaoh.
A dead pharaoh.
That sounds like a big negative. I'm actually really happy about it.
It's the story of Dorothy Eady, which I'd heard of before. I mean, she's quite famous. Her story is well known, but I'd never really looked into it.
Is that the Om Seti woman?
Yeah, she goes by the name, or she went by the name Om Seti. She passed away in the 1980s, but her story is really fascinating. And I just kind of wrote it off over all these years because, you know, when you hear some lady who claims she's reincarnated from ancient Egypt and she's adopted some Egyptian name, you just think, oh, it's corny nonsense. But I didn't realize that she was very well respected within Egyptology. She had all these really incredible archaeological skills, and ultimately her memories of being an Egyptian, you know, going back thousands of years, she claims to have these past life memories. They led to discoveries that were still being made based on what she wrote about in the 1990s. Like in the late 1990s, there was some discovery of a temple buried in the desert somewhere, and the archaeologists discovered it because they went into what she wrote about in the 1970s and followed her clues.
What, from her past life memories?
So basically the story begins, and this will be coming up in the plus extension of the show. She was 3 years old, living in a flat in London with her parents, obviously, and she, being a young toddler running around the house, she fell down the stairs. And the family doctor was called, and she was unconscious at the bottom of the stairs, and the doctor pronounced her dead on his arrival. He told the shocked parents and went off to his office to get a death certificate. And when he came back, he was shocked to see the child was fine. She was a bit bruised, but she was now conscious. She was jumping up and down on the bed. She was full of candy, like her parents were over the moon that she was okay.
Had her personality changed?
Well, yeah, here's the thing. After she had this bout of unconsciousness, she started talking about these memories, and she started to beg her parents to take her home, which didn't make any sense because, of course,
she was home.
She was home in London. And it all comes to a point where, about a year later, her parents take her to the British Museum. And of course, at the British Museum, they've got the fantastic Egyptian galleries.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And as soon as she sees the large statues of the Egyptian gods, she's transfixed and suddenly starts performing almost religious rites in front of all these people at the British Museum. She's going down as a child. She's 4 years old. She's kissing the statues' feet. She's doing bowing movements. Eventually, she starts speaking in some kind of ancient tongue that no one understands. This strange knowledge of hieroglyphics comes out. And I'm going to be going into her story later on in this show because it is quite miraculous, especially when a dead pharaoh starts showing up in her bedroom and railing her every night. When she's much older, of course.
Yeah. Not as a That's child. Important to point out that it's when she's much older. No, I'm looking forward to getting into that. But for the rest of this show, or to begin this show, I want to talk about the topic of MILABs, or military abductions. And this is something that we've touched on with the work of Helmut Lemmer in the past. He's got a book that was published about 20 years ago now. I'll link to it in the show notes. It's called MILABs, Military Mind Control and Alien Abduction. But it just so happened that it turns out that this was one of his earlier English publications, but he has got a wealth of German publications that haven't been translated to English that describe some of the more unusual aspects of what people have gone through with these sorts of things. And it appears that there seems to be a group of humans that are well aware of the alien presence here on Earth and are engaged in some type of war, if you will, a clandestine hidden war with these beings that are messing with the human race, and they keep on stepping in for one of two purposes. And we'll go through this. It could be very positive. It could be that they're trying to stop this alien, alleged alien invasion, Or it could be that they're trying to take control of the technology that the ETs are using, and then they're going to use it for their own means. And that's when we start crossing back into what we were talking about on the last Plus show, Ben, with the Caroline group.
Why are they keeping this war secret? Why don't they recruit willing xenophobes like me who want to go and slaughter the aliens?
Because it's far more... It's complicated. It's far more complicated than that. And the ETs don't want to show their hand. These groups don't want to show their hand. And there's been a multitude of researchers over the years, like Helmut, that have come forward with this very small subsection of abductees that describe this element. Because the abductee story, you know, as we know, kind of took off in the 70s, but the Greys didn't really show up until the late 80s, early 90s. And then with most abductees, there really has been this cookie cutter kind of depiction of events that people undergo. It's pretty standard. It's X-Files stuff. We all know those stories. But some researchers, and this is researchers that are connected with MUFON, you know, and other major ufological investigative groups, have pointed out that there are some people that say, yes, I've gone through these abductions and occasionally will encounter Greys, maybe reptilians, sometimes mantis-type beings. There's a whole menagerie of beings that people will encounter. But then they later on get abducted by human-looking beings. Like there's something that it's a very human kind of thing.
Yeah, so this is an idea that's come up in these stories a bunch over the years, is that there are individuals who claim to be taken by non-human entities and have all sorts of things done to them. But then later they'll be taken by, as you said, human-looking people.
Yeah.
Sometimes military, it seems.
Well, they're always wearing either a khaki or fatigues or sometimes, you know, a camouflage-style material.
Yeah, so the speculation is this military outfit, whoever they are, know who alien abductees are. They track these individuals.
Yes.
And after they're taken by the non-humans, they come in and check out the abductee.
You're absolutely right. They're coming in because they're trying to work out why this particular person has been targeted, allegedly. But one thing that they seem to be quite obsessed with is the implants. And it's not the implants that are in just random parts of people's bodies. And those do show up. It's so strange how it's like many aspects of this phenomenon are similar to just the usual experiences that people have, like with implants and that kind of stuff. And like I said, with the typical abductions. But then there's this subset of like, they're only interested in people that have implants placed inside their nasal cavity. Like it's really odd. They focus just on those implants. Most of the reports you find of MILAB-like activity are these people that are seemingly in the military focusing on these nasal implants. And there may be a reason for that. So I want to go back to a publication by Helmut Lamarr, which is New Evidence of Military Involvement in Abductions. And he points out in his preliminary findings, which he published very early on, this is back in the 1980s, he said that he's found that these particular abductees have a particular type of set of experiences following an abduction. They're harassed by dark, unmarked helicopters around their homes, and the military, you know, activity with these helicopters seems to persist for a certain period of time. It's not only aliens that these people experience. They'll also experience being taken underground, they believe, to military facilities. They will see men in white lab coats. They're examined. They're often interrogated. And sometimes the implants are removed and then replaced with a military device.
Is there the same kind of memory recall problems?
Absolutely there is.
That you have with traditional abductions. So does that suggest that whatever human group is doing these has the same kind of memory wiping ability that you see so common in alien abduction stories?
I think you're right there. But what it seems to relate to is that, and this is why they're so focused on these implants, is that that particular implant is so close to a part of the brain that it must emit some type of, you know, it's like a TEMS kind of thing or something that's electrical, which is influencing parts of the brain, right?
Yeah, you were speculating about this on the last show.
This is what I was reading about, and it ends up going down some really crazy ideas about testing, which has been going on since the Second World War. We know that the Nazis, you know, conducted horrific medical experiments.
Yeah, what were you referring to? Wasn't it some kind of patent or something that revealed that there was this ability to send a pulse through the human brain and affect memory, but that's it had to be done from something to do with the nasal cavity?
Yeah, so what it was is this idea was that scientists in, you know, kind of the very dark corners of this type of research, we know that there are things like Michael Persinger, who, you know, says that if you fire a magnetic, you know, energy,
yeah,
essentially.
The God helmet.
The God helmet into the temporal lobe. You can elicit hallucinations, reactions, that kind of stuff. There's been further research that's been done in this for, obviously, war applications. One would be like a weapon that was described as being the diarrhea gun. And I know it sounds stupid, right? It sounds absolutely ridiculous. But what it was they found is
the ultra-low frequencies,
it's an
right?
ultra-low frequency weapon that you can target. You can fire into a group of people in a widespread, and apparently it liquefies all the contents of your bowels and people have diarrhea.
It must be huge, though, because to get those really ultra-low frequencies, you need a large diaphragm woofer, right?
Yes,
so what is
yes.
it, this huge gun you got to carry around?
It's like a bazooka boombox, yeah. which is put on your shoulders. I don't know what it is. There's no depictions of what the actual instruments are. It's more just the application of what these things could do. But further to that, apparently that kind of research led into... there was this offshoot. There was some type of side effect where they realized that it was affecting people's minds. It was causing memory loss when they were exposed to these ultra-low frequencies, when they were exposed to magnetic fields. But they also found that they were capable of inserting and removing memories, allegedly, right? I don't know how they'll go about inserting memories, but the removal of memories kind of sounds, or the suppression of memories sounds consistent with what we hear with abductions. But one thing that was cited is the reason why these implants are being used is because it's pretty nonspecific. Like when you fire these things at a group of people or a certain individual, apparently it has some very, a wide variation of effects. Yeah, it might delete memories. Yes, it might cause hallucinations. In some circumstances, it might trigger some weird kind of out-of-body effect. But it never has an exact desired effect. Like every single time you fire it, hoping to get a certain effect, it's going to be different. So the way this group got around it, well, this research got around it, was by the utilization of an implant up in the nasal cavity. And by having this thing up in the nasal cavity, you actually get it to release the pulse, the ELF, what do you want it to do, very, very close to the part of the brain which will elicit the removal of memories or the suppression of memories. And so what you can actually do, you don't have to worry about firing that particular frequency or that ELF or whatever, you know, into a person's brain remotely. You just have to send a signal to get the implant to behave in a certain way. And that was the idea, is that this is something that's been worked on for a long time. And then you cross into the more of the extreme conspiracy theories, is that this technology didn't specifically come from the natural progression and development of technologies from humanity.
Okay.
It's come from the ETs have been implanting implants into people for a long time, for at least the last 40 to 50 years. And these secretive groups that have been following this have been retrieving those implants and beginning to understand what their purpose is. And it does fit, right? Because we've speculated in the past, you know, people like Jacques Vallée have looked at the idea of implants. And is it that the person can be located? But that doesn't seem to be the effect. It seems like people don't have implants and they're still found repeatedly. Yeah. So that doesn't seem to be what it's being used for. So it doesn't make sense that it is being used to suppress people's memories, to alter their recollections of experiences. And in some extreme examples, like we've spoken about with the whole out-of-body abductions, is that what it's being used for? Does it induce some type of out-of-body effect that they don't have to, you know, spend a whole heap of time or effort into doing? It's just something that is associated with the abduction. So Lamar points out that during November of 1996, the British press actually reported that the British Ministry of Defence had been carrying out secret radiation experiments on humans for the past 40 years. Then around the same time in 1994, the Clinton administration looked into this as well in the US. They found that 23,000 Americans were involved in 1,400 different projects in 30 years following the war relating to these radiation and electromagnetic experiments. You then have people like Dr. Edwin Cameron, who was a scientist on the surface, but he actually led the CIA-funded laboratory at McGill University, where patients were used in brainwashing experiments. Right now, this is important to point out because there's factors here that will come up in the stories that I'm going to describe of the actual claimed victims of these MILAB experiments. And what they would be exposed to with Dr. Edward Cameron was that they were given ECT, like electroconvulsive therapy, twice a day to seemingly induce some type of memory deprivation. Others were drugged and kept unconscious allegedly for weeks or months. Others were injected with huge amounts of hallucinogens, and some were even subjected to long-term sensory deprivation. In fact, the Clinton administration in 1994 found that between 1944 and 1975, the actual breadth of these experiments will never fully be known. And they found that the experiments continued at least into the mid-1970s. So this stuff has been happening for a while.
Yeah, and most of the stuff was from MKUltra, right?
That's right.
It all got torched.
That's right. Well, I mean, there was a Canadian psychiatrist and specialist on trauma and dissociation. His name was Dr. Colin Ross. He presented a paper that showed that released FOI documents or FOIA documents from the CIA demonstrated that the agency was clearly working on the creation of Manchurian candidates. Now, that's, again, conspiracy theory stuff, right? It sounds nuts. Well, no, apparently that's exactly what they were looking into. And the way that they were doing it was utilizing horrific experiments involving electroconvulsive shock therapy, drugs, and brain implants.
And you really need that memory wipe for your Manchurian candidate, don't you?
You
know, you get them to do something horrible and then...
And it's gone.
Wipe the slate clean.
Well, I mean, this is one of the
perfect assassin.
Well, not only that, you know, because obviously people are still human beings, and unless you're a complete sociopath... You know, you're going to have feelings about doing this kind of stuff, doing something horrible. Well, if you erase that memory, people have no recollection of it. So they're not going to, their actual asset is not going to be affected by it. So with this kind of stuff, there is this history of it. The next thing that comes up that was found by Lamar was that there's been liquid breathing experiments that have been conducted for 30, 40 years. And the problem with these experiments is that they haven't always gone well. They've found with animal experiments, and it's quite horrible, that while they were able to keep animals in an organic liquid, I believe, for a certain period of time, it caused a buildup of fluorocarbons or something in the lung and caused severe damage to the lung. So we've never been really able to perform these liquid breathing experiments without any type of permanent damage.
Why do we need liquid breathing? What's the application?
Well, there's a whole heap of... One idea is...
Apart from space travel and some kind of sci-fi application.
Space travel to avoid shocks in extremely fast travel. So the idea is that if you're...
You're in some jelly liquid.
You're in some type of liquid and your lungs are filled with the liquid, your lungs won't collapse and you'll be able to withstand higher G-forces. It also have aerospace applications in regards to spy planes. All that's kind of gone by the wayside, though, in the preceding decades, because it's like, well, we have drones now. We don't need to worry about using a human. But this is stuff that was looked at many, many years ago. But I'll link to the actual story, because I'm not going to go into it in great detail today because it's kind of beside the point. But I will point out that Lamar has the story of Michelle. And if you are familiar with MILABS, this is a really well-known kind of case, but it has these elements that fit into the story that I'm going to be telling you today. And with Michelle, she was about 8 years old when she'd been experiencing something with non-human intelligences for a period of time. And of course, it was classic. She was interacting with 3 to 4 foot tall beings with large heads. We know what it is. It's the greys, right? But many years later, she started having these traumatic flashbacks. Now, recall that, right? These flashbacks seem to, again, have something to do with the memory suppression failing in some of these people. And she would have reality-like dreams that she could ultimately start consciously remembering MILAB events that were taking place in her life. And these gaps in her memory were actually investigated through a professional hypnotherapist who was a MUFON consultant. And all that she recalls in a nutshell in this story is that in the 1970s, she was near a campsite in Montauk, of all places, and we know the history that Montauk has. She remembers being with her boyfriend. They were woken up while they were camping. They were taken by armed military personnel to the closed Montauk base. They were separated. She was escorted to an underground facility where she had these frightening experiences. And it was very much like a typical alien-style abduction where she was exposed to a whole heap of weird surgical procedures. They shaved a small portion of the back of her head just behind her right ear. She was conscious, but she was immobilized and she couldn't talk. And she felt them writing something on the skin behind her ear before she got this pain in there. It's like they inserted something behind the ear. And when she had basically she found herself back in the camp and she's just wandering along the beach with her boyfriend, and they both realized that they had been somewhere else. Like the memory started coming back. And in this memory, she recalls floating in some type of liquid that was heavier than water. She was in some type of breathable liquid.
Right.
And there were people in white lab coats standing around outside her. And she was horrified by this, but she said that this substance had this minty kind of scent to it. And all of this seems like it's hallucinations, but Lamar points out that Dr. John Lilly, and we know a lot about John Lilly's research in sensory deprivation and ISO tanks and that kind of stuff, that he was trying to do research into stimulating out-of-body experiences. And guess what? One element of that is that he looked at was implants. He looked at utilizing implants in conjunction with the tanks to see if you could induce out-of-body experiments. So this is something that he was looking at in the late 50s and early 60s. So this was during a period where you've got, you know, the Department of Defense, intelligence agencies starting to see what edge can they get. So this is all, you know, under the auspices of, you know, national defense and that kind of stuff. But there seems to be something else that was going on around this time. And people like Michelle, you know, she experienced a whole range of high strangeness during some of these and after some of these MILAB encounters. These traumatic flashbacks kept on coming. One thing she pointed out was that, and it was horrible, but she recalled, as she describes it in great detail, of being taken into this office. It was this dark, but just a normal kind of office. And when she was taken in there, she was presented with this reptilian. Like, she was drugged.
What?
And there was a reptilian standing there, and he was fully erect. And I mean, he was fully erect.
Oh, we get what you're saying.
And she got railed by this reptilian. It's a horrible, horrible, dreadful thing. And some people have speculated that this was part of the drugs. Like, they were testing to see what the drug, but something else had happened. But all these elements that I've described have shown up in another case. Like, there's something very strange which is occurring here. And so what we have to do now is we have to go to the story of Leah Haley. And Leah Haley is a very, very interesting individual who ultimately ends up completely turning on this story. It's
my turning on the story.
Yeah. Her perception.
What do you mean? Like, denying it?
Not denying it. She believes that there's no such thing as alien abductions.
Right.
As recently as 2009, she has come out because she disappeared. I mean, this woman was quite famous inside UFO circles in 1993, 1994. And clearly, you know, she was affected by something. And as of 2009, as she kind of stepped out of the limelight, other researchers have come forward. And I'll link to an article where, you know, people have tried to contact her. And her attitude is now is that there is no such thing as an alien abduction. It's all humans. It's all some type of mass experiment that's being conducted. But I don't think that's exactly the case.
Where does she stand on the lizard people?
Well, the lizard people do show up. So what I want to play for you today is actually some audio. It's really well done interview that was conducted with her in 1994, where she describes how her entire life seemingly has been infiltrated with these experiences. And just to set the scene, essentially what happened was that she had a normal family life. Everything was going just great in her life. She was building a house. She had a family. She had two teenage kids. Everything was going well. When in July of 1990, she went up to a parent's place, and apparently one morning she was at the breakfast table sitting with her mother, and her mother opens up the paper. It's just like the local rag. And the mother goes, "Oh, look, UFOs. Oh, how silly." Something along those lines. And Leah's reaction was like, "Oh, And she's never really thought about UFOs before, but for whatever reason, she was like, "Oh, why do you think it's not real?" And they got into this deep and meaningful discussion about UFOs when she's like, "Do you recall what my brother and I spoke about when we were kids?" And straight away, she's like, yeah, I do. And what this was is that when she was a kid, her and her brother had seen this weird craft that was floating over the back of their home. It was this silver kind of spheroid shape that was up in the sky. It was extremely bright. It was in broad daylight. And they kept on watching this thing hover over the back of their home for 20, 30 minutes. And it seemed to descend down into the woods just next to their home. Now, she went running into the woods with her brother and another friend to go and see whatever this thing was. And they didn't find anything. And they're actually all quite disappointed because they thought they were going to see a flying saucer. And she herself says, "Look, we thought it was a flying saucer at the time. We were excited to see what we could find." And they found nothing. And the mother's like, "Oh, how about we ask your brother when he comes up here?" And he did. The brother came up and the brother's like, "Yeah, I remember that. But it's really strange. Why is it that we haven't spoken about this in decades? Like, we had this weird experience and it's like 30 years later. Why is it only now we're talking about it?" And it was like all of these memories started rushing back. There was something that was coming back to them. And she was like, this, maybe this was a dream. Like maybe there was something that was not right about it, but she wasn't sure, but she was unable to forget this incident that happened in 1990. And so the discussion continued at this table where the brother was saying, oh, you know, maybe you should consider getting some regression hypnotherapy. And she was like, oh, actually, that's a good idea. Incidentally, the mother and the brother had been reading communion. She hadn't. She had nothing to do with communion. And she's sitting there. She's like, oh, you know, now that I think about it, I've had a whole heap of dreams about, you know, weird things taking place and there being these little men that come into the room and typical abductee kind of stuff, right? But she said that they were chalky. They weren't greys. She said they were like this chalky kind of 3 foot tall beings, like a little bit different in their color. And apparently the mother and the brother sat there with their faces just becoming whiter and whiter. Like they were clearly more distressed about what she was describing. She says, right. What's wrong? What's with your facial features? And the brother and mother said, well, we've been reading communion and what you're describing is consistent with what Strieber is describing. Maybe you should go and find a regressionist, a hypnotherapist. And guess who she ends up finding? She writes to Bud Hopkins.
Oh, right.
This is how
good choice.
Yeah, good. Exactly. So she gets in contact with Bud Hopkins. And let me play this audio for you because this was the interview that was conducted in 1994 where she had to find out if these experiences were real. And it was almost like by her being triggered to try and uncover these experiences, a whole heap of other high strangeness started taking place. Take a listen.
I decided that I had to find out whether this encounter was real or not. I put it off for a while. And then finally, I called my brother and asked him if he could give me the name of someone who could help me determine whether my so-called dream was actually a dream or a real event. He put me in touch with Bud Hopkins. He gave me Bud Hopkins' name and address. I wrote to Bud, and it was several months before I got a response. In the meantime, I noticed some odd things started happening to me. I started being followed by cars, white sedans, dark blue sedans. Sometimes it seemed that cars were following me that were of other colors, and this unnerved me somewhat. I didn't know why all of a sudden I was being followed. I noticed that I started having odd noises on my telephone, sometimes music, sometimes beeping sounds, sometimes buzzing in the background. Sometimes it sounded as if a cassette tape were winding around in a cassette recorder. Sometimes I would hear voices over the line. I'd never had those things occur before I wrote to Bud Hopkins asking for help. And another thing that happened to me that I thought was very odd is I came home from work one day and discovered that the locks on the exterior doors were loose. That upset me somewhat, and I couldn't understand why these things started happening all of a sudden when I decided to examine the possibility of my so-called dream being a real event.
So if this is really happening, I guess you could say that Bud Hopkins is being monitored, and anyone who contacts Bud Hopkins is then put on the watch list.
That's right. That's what my inference was as well. And, you know, with the MILAB kind of stuff, look, it's a very, because as I said, you know, it's this subcategory of abductees, and abductees already have, you know, you've got to approach it with an air of skepticism. You know, there are some people out there that make some pretty outrageous claims. When you dive into the MILABs, it starts crossing over into gang stalking, people obviously experiencing some very disturbing emotional problems.
Yeah. Paranoid delusions,
all that kind of stuff, mental illness, all of that does come up. But I think the reason why I particularly chose Leah Haley's case is because the elements of her story are consistent with that was described by Michelle and what she experienced in Montauk. Also, you know, Dr. Carla Turner had described MILABs as well. And, you know, she seems to be a very respectable member who has sadly passed away of the UFO community. And the way that she presents herself, Leah Haley, you know, I know that this is from 1994, but she's very sincere. I mean, she comes across as being very sincere. She doesn't appear to be someone who is, you know, a raving lunatic. I mean, let me give you one example, right? So as I was preparing for today's show, I was trying to find, you know, some more experiences that people had had. And I found, I'm not saying this particular person is a raving lunatic. However, I did find that they were talking about their experiences with MILHAFs. Sorry.
Come on, what happened? Who'd Rogered them? Who gave them a good shafting, as
they,
you would say.
They find that they are abducted...
By Lizard Man.
By the Japanese. And these Japanese... These
tiny,
two,
diminutive...
These two Japanese, right? While the abduction is taking place, they feel sympathy for the abductee, and they're like, because this abductee is there naked, like, oh no, and they give her a kimono. I'm like, do they really? And the person's like, oh, well, then I realized that this was a Japanese Milab, but there's a whole range of different experiences. It's like,
it's hilarious.
Oh dear.
Japanese Milab.
Yeah. So I was
that's
like,
a whole show on its own.
I know, it really is. I thought, I'll just skip out of that. So look, there are people that have these, you know, weird kind of outlying experiences, but going back to Leah, so she's starting to get disturbed, but she's trying to unpick this thread that's in her memory of having some type of interaction, and it all becomes very real to her and very disturbing.
In October of 1990, I woke up one morning above my bed, not in it. I felt that I was awake, that it was really something that happened, that it wasn't a dream. But I had no explanation for it. I also remember being in a beam of light. I was lying horizontally in a beam of light. But after it happened, I thought, this is weird. Something's wrong with me. I'm going crazy. Things like this just can't happen.
So she's terrified. I mean, she's starting to look to Bud Hopkins for assistance with these memories that are coming to the surface. And all of a sudden, she finds herself floating in a beam of light in her bedroom. Well, this, you know, obviously, as she points out there, distressed her, and she really does think she's going crazy. So this is why she embarks on a series of hypnotic regressions. And these regressions end up going into, I think she has a total of 14 these regressions.
And you've got the entire transcript to read to us today, verbatim.
No, not quite. Not quite. But there is, you know.
Because there's nothing more boring than reading regression transcripts.
Oh, I know. Yes, I know. I'm not going to go into that. There is some of it available online. And look, this actually ties in to the John Carpenter affair. And what this is, right? So John Carpenter was involved in a lot of these hypnotic regression sessions that were taking place around the time. And I believe I'm not entirely sure, but I think he was involved in the regression of Michelle, right? And where this kind of stands out and where this becomes muddy in the genre is that apparently John Carpenter was gotten to by someone. And there's a point actually where Leah points out that he was gotten to, like he was conducting these regression sessions about Milabs. Like he was pulling up a lot of this stuff. He conducted a total of 140 cases. Guess what he did? This is supposed to be confidential. He sold all of it to someone. Like this is all confidential regression Milab stuff. And he sold it. Guess who he sold it to?
Who?
Robert Bigelow.
Oh.
He sold it to Bigelow Aerospace, well, not the company, but Robert Bigelow, who we know is involved in, obviously, aerospace technologies and other weird high strangeness. He was associated with the Skinwalker Ranch. Why would he do that? And one of the arguments that was put forward by Leah was that something had gotten to him. I don't know what, and I don't know where. It's very messy, and it's very difficult, but this was a massive affair and a big scandal that happened in the UFO community.
He bought it because something got to him. What does that mean?
Well, the suggestion is that these groups that are responsible for the Milabs are the ones that caused him to turn the information over. Perhaps he was influenced. Like, he'd gotten so close to what was happening with the Milabs that they used their influence to cause him to be compelled. You know, and what I mean is controlled to hand this information over to Bigelow. But for what purpose, no one knows. And it's only mere speculation. No one knows exactly what happened, and the guy disappeared into obscurity after this took place as well. But going back to what happened with Leah, remember how I told you there that she has this memory that she's talking to her mother about being walking into the woods after seeing this UFO, and all she recalls is that she came out of the woods being disappointed because she didn't see anything. Oh, she saw something.
In the first session, I examined the memory of the childhood sighting where my brother and I saw the UFO and we went looking for it in the woods. Well, under regression, I remembered that as soon as we got into the woods, we split up. And I remembered that I went off to the right and I was walking through the woods looking for this flying saucer that we thought had landed there. but I didn't find the flying saucer. What I saw was a chalky-colored creature standing in front of a big tree. And I remembered in the hypnosis session being frightened when I saw him. And I remembered that with his big black eyes, he talked to me and told me not to be afraid. And I remembered he took me by the hand. And there's a lapse in memory at that point. The next thing I remembered was being in a different part of the woods. And in a clearing, I could see this spaceship, this spherical spaceship, just hovering above the ground. And I remembered that a beam of white light just came down upon the entity and me, beamed us somehow aboard the craft. I remember being in the light, and then the next memory I have is being aboard the craft, lying on a platform with other entities, the same height, same shape, who are standing around me, poking my arms and legs. And then the next thing I remembered about that incident was being back at the edge of the woods, joining the others, and we all walked out of the woods disappointed we hadn't seen anything.
It's a pretty standard grey alien abduction scenario.
That's right, yeah, and this erasure of her memory, because later on she describes that, yeah, she was disappointed that she hadn't seen anything and none of this had come back. Now, after this...
And they're chalky, but they're greys.
They're greys, exactly. But this experience, you know, she said it was like the eyes were somehow transmitting something into her. Mm-hmm. She was feeling extremely distressed. But what took place on board that craft is something that comes up a little bit later. But obviously, when she came into this hypnotic regression, straight away she's like, that's not real, that didn't happen. She goes into this state of denial, essentially. You know, she goes down this path of that wasn't real and this can't have happened and I must have made it up. But she continues with the hypnosis sessions and this compulsion of the white beam, which she described earlier there, you know, waking up in her bedroom and floating in it. It seems like there's this element of control that's associated with that, because listen to what happens during the second hypnotic regression.
In the second hypnosis session, we examined what I called a dream that happened when I was an adult, of being in a round room, having medical exams performed on me. We explored that. And I remembered additional details about that incident. Under regression, I remembered that I walked out of the house myself. Something compelled me to walk out the door and around into the backyard. And in the backyard, I saw the spherical object hovering in the air. And again, a beam of white light took me aboard. And I lay on a platform while identical looking creatures perform gynecological type procedures on me.
So we're fitting back into, it's still this classical kind of element, but the element that I want to mention for you there is this feeling of compulsion, right? This ties in with other MILAB reports where it's like that implant is causing the person to be compelled. It's like connected to the light. It's causing them to behave in a certain way. Go outside, go to an open space so they can be beamed from wherever they are or taken aboard the craft.
So far, this has nothing to suggest that this is anything other than the typical alien abduction trope.
You're right. You're absolutely right. And it sounds like she is being abducted by aliens. It fits in with all of the standard alien abduction stories, because even amongst the cases of MILABs, right, when people are taken by alleged actual extraterrestrials, they're in round rooms. There's light that comes seemingly from no place. You know, it's a very sterile kind of environment. But when the MILABs take place and they're trying to mimic what's taking place, they're in square rooms and there's light from a fixed location. So there's these subtle elements that come up in this where you can start to see where there's a difference. But what's happened during some of these abductions? I just want to play a piece of audio for you that is exactly like what happened to that woman, Michelle, who claims that she was involved in a MILAB.
I remembered something being done to my right ear. I felt what seemed to be a piercing sensation and pain in two places, right behind my ear and deep inside my ear.
Yeah, right. Was there anyone writing anything on the back of her head?
No, that wasn't described. But what this fits into with other researchers, and like Helmut, for example, was that apparently there were people up in high-level groups that are paramilitary. They were concerned that these ETs are inserting implants into people to be able to remotely activate them for whatever purposes. Now, when they say remotely activate. This ties in with all of that research that was being conducted that found that not only can you alter people's memories, erase and suppress memories, you can alter neurochemistry. You can cause people to become more violent. You can cause people to have outbursts. You can cause people to collapse. There's a whole range of things that can happen. And apparently amongst these very, very, very secretive groups, there was some fear that the reason why that they were monitoring this, and maybe this is one of the explanations for why MILabs take place, is because they're not trying to get hold of the technology, although that would be good. It's to monitor what they're doing, because more and more and more of these ETs are invading the human realm, our space, and are basically setting up a whole heap of sleeper cells ready for the final takeover. Now, this was speculated back in the 70s and 80s, so a lot of time has passed now. But I guess if they waited this long, is this what the plan is long term? And why
all these abductees are old ladies now?
I know. And why
what are they taking over?
Exactly. And why is more of it not showing up in X-rays and that kind of stuff? Well, the reason is apparently they're being removed at the same time.
I remember being in some kind of a transparent container. I don't know what they were doing with me there or what was happening to me. I do know that my ear hurt. When I was in this facility, my right ear, the one that I had recalled the aliens messing with earlier. And I do know that after this encounter, I no longer heard some Morse code type beeps in my right ear that I had been hearing previously. I assume that these individuals removed something from my ear that had been causing tones.
What individuals? What is she talking about?
So this is suggesting that this is the MILab where she was abducted by humans that had placed her inside a transparent container, which we hear in other MILab accounts, and that they placed her inside that container to keep her obviously restrained while they removed this implant. And interestingly enough, she actually describes in the audio that in May of 1991, which was after she'd had the first regression, right? She claims that she suddenly started receiving telepathic communications of some kind from an unknown source. And here I'm thinking, okay, well, lady, you might be suffering from undiagnosed schizophrenia. Like, there must be something that's going on here. There must be a rational explanation for it. But she claims that what was coming through was these weird hieroglyphic kind of symbols that were influencing her. She doesn't go into great detail as to what it was for, but she could see these things constantly moving. And I thought, well, what could this be for? And it becomes apparent a little bit later on that maybe this ties in with some type of control. Like something was maybe trying to alter her, maybe to do with the implant. I don't know what it was, trying to suppress what she was trying to uncover. But she takes a very, and as I said before, she takes a very strange turn. But before we get to that, what I want to play for you, and I have to set the scene for this, is that after she's had these two regressions, she's working as like a teacher, she's working as an accounting teacher, and she was on spring break. And she said that she'd gone to her place of work. And when she'd gone to her place of work, there were just a few other people around, but the building was pretty much empty. And she thought, oh, here's a great chance for me to be able to catch up on some work and grade some papers and do that kind of thing. And she said she felt compelled, again, right? She felt compelled to go back to her car to recover a letter or a piece of paper that was in the car. And she claims that when she went outside, she stopped because she said there was this man, this military-style man that was snooping around her car. Like, he was clearly looking like he was trying to get into her car. And she thought, oh, is he trying to break into my car? Is he a robber? But he doesn't look like a robber. You know, he's kind of clean cut and wearing this blue kind of uniform. And who is this guy? And ultimately, he apparently noticed he's holding some type of tool or instrument, and she can't see what it is. She can't work out what it is. But ultimately, he realizes that she's watching, that she's come outside and sprung him. So he goes off and starts looking around through the grass next to the car, pretending like he's looking for his keys or something. And she doesn't know what to do. She's disturbed by this. And she thought, maybe I should confront him. And she decides not to, but she goes and gets in her car. And when she sits in the car, the guy just stares at her, and they have this stare off back and forward. And she's like, this is not normal. This guy is not normal. There's something really weird going on. And she realizes that his truck is parked right up her rear end. Like, there's this truck behind her, a van,
right,
that's right up her rear end of her car. And he just gets in it. He throws this instrument, this tool, we never find out what it is. He throws it into the back of his car. He backs up the truck and she gets his license plate number. Like, she's like, it's too late. I got it. And he drives away. She spends 2 months. This is how nuts this is. She spends 2 months with her contacts and a whole heap of people to find out who, like, had the...
Trace the number.
Trace the number plate, right? She finds out that it's for a man that works for a contracting company for NASA. And his job is working on apparently some type of stabilization technology for the external fuel tanks.
What the hell?
That's what she says. She's like, what the hell is some military NASA contractor doing trying to get into my car? This is strange, right? So around this time, while this is all taking place and she's trying to have these hypnotic regressions, she moves into her new home, which was just being built. And as soon as she moves into this house, she says the external locks are messed with. The alarm system keeps on malfunctioning. She gets the alarm company to come out and check on the alarm. And the alarm company is actually getting quite exasperated with it because they said something keeps on erasing the memory inside the system controller. We don't know what's going on. And she says this is like an element of clearly something building. Like it's getting uncomfortable for her and she's quite disturbed. So what I want to play for you now is this weird connection, right? She finds out that it's a guy associated with the space shuttle. Weird. Like, why? What does it have to do with the space shuttle? Well, around this time, she gets an invitation to go and view the space shuttle Endeavour, which was going to be at the base where she was working. So because she was a teacher...
Why would she get an invitation?
That's the thing. Because she was a teacher, she was running this accounting course, and she gets an invite through one of her students. Take a listen.
Another incident that helped confirm the reality of my experiences was an invitation to view the space shuttle Endeavour. One night I was teaching an accounting course at the local Air Force base. The university where I taught had a contract to teach X amount of courses at the Air Force base, and I was teaching one of the accounting courses out there. And the last night of lectures, the week before final exams, when all the students were leaving, one of my adult female students approached my desk and handed me something. And she said to me, my husband said to give this to you. And I looked at what she gave me, and it looked like some kind of a patch. And I said, what is this? She said, it's a patch of the space shuttle Endeavour. And I said, okay, why did your husband send this to me? And she said, I don't know. He just told me to give it to you. Why is this woman's husband, who I later learned was a captain in the Air Force, why was he sending me a patch of the space shuttle Endeavour? So when I got home that night, I looked up the phone number of this woman and I called her husband and said, thank you for sending me the patch of the space shuttle Endeavour, but I'm rather curious, why did you do it? He said to me, well, my wife has enjoyed your accounting class so much, I just wanted to give you a token of our appreciation.
And he's just being nice.
Is he?
Yeah.
Is he though?
I was thinking in my head, this is a bunch of garbage. This woman does not like my accounting course that much. You know, this doesn't make sense.
She obviously doesn't realize how good her accounting course is.
Well, it fits into the larger story, though, because you've got to remember, she's describing this in, obviously everything that's happened in the past. And like, we don't even need to continue there, because basically what happens is this guy, this military officer, he's like, no, look, we really want to reward you. I want you to come and see the space shuttle Endeavour, which is going to be at the base. I would love you to come and see it. By the way, this is an invitation just for you. You can't tell anyone about this and, you could get into trouble, but make sure you bring along a camera because I'll make sure I get some really great photographs of you with the space shuttle. You're going to love it. And she's just like...
She's just being friendly.
Sure he is, right?
What's wrong with it?
Sure he is.
There's nothing weird. I also think the guy that was snooping around her car probably did drop something and he was just looking for it. He just happened to be parked near her.
Maybe.
And the staring contest between the two, she's the one that's being weird and he's just like, who is this weird woman? Why is she staring at me?
Maybe.
Is she just paranoid and completely delusional?
She could be, but I mean, she comes across as someone who is very high functioning. Like, she's extreme. Although we do know, and this is what a lot of the MILLAB stuff crosses into, it crosses into all the super soldier stuff. That's where it becomes really batty. But with this, right?
So I'm just waiting for her to have sex with a reptilian.
I hate to disappoint you, but okay, well, there is a little bit of sex with a reptilian. Yes, that does happen later on. But so she, skipping forward, right? She's like, no, I'm.
So she doesn't take the trip.
She doesn't take it. She's like, look, I thank you so much. It's very, very nice of you, but I've got exams coming up. I have to give the final week of exams and I can't do it. The final exam will be next week. And he hangs up the phone, right? And she thinks that's the last that she'll hear of him until she's there. Actually, she's like stood in front of her class. She's handed out the exam papers this following week and she sits down. She says, you have 1 hour and 20 minutes to complete the exam. And as soon as she sits down, she looks up and there's an Air Force officer standing at the door and he's like beckoning her. And so she gets up and comes over and says, oh, and she looks at his name tag and it's him. It's this guy. He's like, okay, let's go. Let's go. She said, what are you doing here? And he's like, the shuttle, it's here. You have to go now. And she said that he had this real urgency about him, which was odd. And she said, I can't go. I've got my students here. All my students are here doing their exam. I can't leave. And he's like, oh, they won't care. Don't worry about it. Oh, it's okay.
Yeah, this is a bit weird.
She said he was agitated. He was wringing his hands. He was hot and sweaty. There was something that was odd and he was extremely insistent. And every time she said, no, I'm not going, he got worse and worse and worse to the point where he was ultimately rude when she's like, listen, I'm not coming. I'm not coming to see this. Now, the night goes, like it all ends. But the following day, she says that she's got the paper that's been delivered. And I think it must be like the base paper or something. But she picks it up and she insists that on this page, it was all about how all these military personnel had been deployed to protect the shuttle and they'd been given shoot to kill orders. Her claim is that they had set her up to take her camera to go.
So she would trespass.
She would trespass in front of, go, well, she thinks that she's invited. She would take her camera. She would wander up to the shuttle. She'd take a whole heap of pictures and she would be shot.
Why don't they just use the diarrhea gun on 11? This is such an elaborate assassination attempt. It would make the news. It would be all over the place. This is such an insane assassination attempt.
You are right. Like, but it would just be written off as it being an accident. Like it was a mistake.
Just do the usual cut the brake lines of a car and she goes off a cliff.
That's too elaborate.
They've got the heart attack gun, but no, they have to have this elaborate touring NASA assassination attempt.
I understand, you know, your apprehension about the story, as and most people would, but she's appeared, you know, amongst these circles later on. And it's a good question, right? People have asked her, why you? Like, why you? What is it about you that these MILABs are concerned about you? Why are they taking you? And she's like, it's because I was involved in the crash of a UFO.
One possible explanation is that I was involved in a crash of a spaceship. I remember being aboard a craft, aboard a spaceship, and I remember looking out the porthole onto the ocean below. I'm not 100% positive where this took place, but I have an idea. Anyway, I was looking out the porthole and I saw a military ship on the ocean below. And while I was looking at it, I felt a jolt. And I remember falling backwards and hitting my head on something. And the next thing I recall was waking up and walking out an opening of the craft onto a beach, sandy area. And I remember hearing airplanes and helicopters overhead. And I remembered seeing a man with an alien creature over his shoulder. I remembered seeing a lifeboat approach the shore, and two men motioned for me to come aboard that lifeboat. Before that happened, when I walked out onto the beach toward the water, I remember somebody yelling at me to stay where I was. Somebody said, stay right there, don't move. I remember getting into the lifeboat, not struggling, but going with two men in the lifeboat out to the big military ship. And once I climbed up into the ship, climbed up a ladder onto the ship, And once I got on deck, I remember a man in uniform helping me onto the deck. And once I got up there, I saw one alien still alive lying on the deck of the ship. I don't know whether this was the same alien that I saw earlier on the beach or not, but there are several aliens that are unaccounted for in my mind. I don't know what happened to them. I know that there were at least four aliens aboard the craft with me, and two men grabbed me and took me down some stairs onto a lower deck of the ship. And the last thing I remember was sitting down on a stair and putting my head in my lap.
Wait,
I don't remember anything else.
So how did she crash the craft? Did I miss that?
So that's it. She doesn't explain that. No, you haven't missed
it. She said that her head hit something. Did she hit the landing lever? She hit the landing gear button on the dashboard.
No. So later on, she says in September of 1992, she had, as all these memories were coming back, she seemed to be able to recall where it was. And she said it was actually somewhere in the Gulf Breeze area. And she went down to this beach with other researchers. And she says when she went there, it was near an Air Force base. And it just so happened in this Air Force base, allegedly, there was some type of pulse weapon that was there that had been used to bring the craft down. So she was just happened to be an abductee aboard the craft when it would happen to be taken down.
Love it.
And this is how she got involved in all these MILAPs.
Bring them all down.
So she was already...
She's rescued from an abduction.
Well, she was already dealing with ETs. And it just, and we've heard this in another case as well. There was another case, I think Nick Redfern covered years ago, of a downed saucer. And in that particular story, I don't remember the details of it, but they found a human female abductee aboard. So there were dead greys, and I don't know what happened to the abductee, but they found a human abductee in this crashed saucer. So it's not the first time that this has taken place.
But she survived the crash, according to the story?
I can't recall, but she did in this particular case. You know, Leah survived, and as we know, she was taken aboard this military vessel of some kind. But ultimately what happens is you can see that this poor woman is experiencing some form of Stockholm syndrome. There's something which I know we're like, oh, you guys are always so negative about the Greys. Well, we are, because they're horrible, terrible things. Because what she essentially describes is as all these memories are coming back, right? Remember how I was saying about the control, the compulsion that she feels? Like, yeah. She's, you know, compelled to go outside, to go, you know, walk into a field, to go and see this man looking at a car. She says that one evening she's having just her typical abduction with the Greys, where they're performing all of the usual medical procedures upon her. But rather than dropping her home, they drop her in a field and program her to go home. She says, I'm in a zombie-like state.
Well, she walks home.
Yeah, she walks home. But she said,
How far is it?
I don't know how far it is, but she's programmed to go home. And as she's walking home, this is where the MILABs jump in. The military, or whoever this group is, lands with a helicopter in the field and grabs her. They grab her and they take her to a restricted facility. She says she knows it's a restricted facility because she sees the sign restricted. She's taken seemingly into some weird underground place. She doesn't know where she is. And this man starts administering shots. She's given, you know, drugs of some kind. And guess what else? Shock treatment, which was described by Helmut. She's given this, you know, shock treatment.
To mess with her memory,
to mess
presume.
With her. And guess what this guy starts saying to her? He's like, you did not see a flying saucer. You did not see a flying saucer. You didn't see a spaceship. And she's like, oh, but I did. He's like, more shocks, you know, and because like he's trying to do something. And she's like, oh. And she finally comes to, obviously, in her home later on with no recollection of how she got there. But all of this stuff is very, you know, visceral. You know, it's all very, now it's real. But guess what happened? Even in this interview, and I'm not even going to play it because I'll link to it in the show notes so you can listen to the entire thing by yourself. This interview is over an hour long. But she says, and it's strange, this is 1994. She's like, oh, well, after this all happened, I realized that what was going on is that I started receiving these communications and understanding what they were. And that was I had to write children's books, and she did, right? She wrote a children's book to calm other children about how to tolerate the abduction scenario.
What?
I know. I'm like, how sinister is this lady? I'm like, lady, this is really sinister. Can you not see what is going on here? And she's like, oh, it's about, you know, telling the kids that they don't have to be scared and it's going to be, I'm like, this is sick. right? This is actually sick. And she doesn't even realize that this is being done to her. And then of course, you know, 2009, she's completely changed her attitude. As of 2009, it was that there is no such thing as alien abductions. This entire thing.
Everything's a psyop.
Everything's some type of psyop. And I'm beginning to wonder, right, where I was approaching this with a very open mind, where I'm thinking, is this woman some type of high-functioning paranoid schizophrenic?
Well, she's got a funny kind of monotone delivery to
which is
these,
a psychiatric,
you know,
symptom.
Traumatic stories. You know, I don't want to read too much into her retelling of her experiences, but there seems to be, there's just something off about it. I don't know quite what it is.
Yeah, I mean, if you've been through something like that, I mean, maybe that's just all it is. Like, she's so traumatized, she's so messed up, she's so confused about what's happened. You know, she's not just your typical abductee. She's also got this other element going on. Maybe it's just that she can only speak about it slowly in a monotone kind of voice to be able to get the details out. Or is it something else? You know, is it that she is, you know, almost crossing into the line of the crazed super soldier kind of stuff. And that, as I said before, does come up a lot. But then, of course, I read a story on our website from Nick Redfern. Nick Redfern only this week published this really fascinating account of Charles. And it all solidified a lot of this for me. Because obviously I've been preparing this over the last couple of days and reading different stories and trying to, you know, make heads or tails of what's going on. But there's a story of Charlie. So Nick says that the phenomenon of Millabs is actually very much ongoing. And there's a significant case from 2015. And it started with Charlie contacting Nick in late 2016. And of course, we know with Nick, because he's on, you know, television shows and writes books, he has a whole heap of people, you know, contacting him about their experiences. Well, Charlie points out that in January of 2015, this is the 2nd of January, he had an encounter that he wished he could forget. And this incident actually, it seems to be like some type of Millab crossed with ET abduction. I'm not entirely sure. But what he says is that he was at home in a quiet, isolated area on the fringes of the city. And his parents went home because they were visiting friends in Florida. And he was just lying on the couch watching TV. And he must have drifted off because it was around 2 a.m. when he suddenly had a weird compulsion, again, to go to the living room window. Now, he cautiously opens up the blinds and looks out to see this police car parked outside the house. And there's nothing that unusual about it, but I guess you would question if you've got a police car outside your house, like, oh, what's going on here?
And he says, this the one where the police officer's grinning at him?
Yes. Yeah.
Like, giving him this weird smile.
That's right. He says he feels all weird. Like there's just an odd kind of feeling about him, almost like he was also half awake. It was like this dreamlike kind of world, much like what Leah described of being in this zombified kind of state. Now he's looking, and he says he decides to go outside and approach the car, and he does. And he finds that there's this police officer, but he's frightening because he's got this really weird smile. It's Nick asks him about it, and you're right, Ben. He said it's an insane smile.
It's like a used car salesman on steroids.
Yeah.
It's like the Woody Derenberger case,
yes,
with Indrid Cold.
Absolutely.
Where this guy just had like a Joker-esque, massive, unnatural, abnormal grin.
Well, he said it was also dangerous. There's something about this grin that was dangerous. And there was another police officer there. There was a partner as well. He was also staring intently at Charlie. And things started to become a blur. And the car and the two officers vanished right before his eyes. And guess what he finds? There's an egg-shaped object around the size of a large truck or a bus,
yeah,
before him. So he said he tried to run, but when he ran, it was like he was running in slow motion and he was getting slower and slower by the step. And all of a sudden he finds himself standing in a field that backed onto the woods behind the family's home. Again, kind of similarities to what happened to Leah's experience. And he said these police officers were no longer police officers. They were classic men in black. They had dark suits, old fedora-style hats, weird pale skin and enlarged eyes. And they hauled him inside this craft. They dragged him inside. And of course, inside there were, you know, weird beings wearing surgeon-like scrubs, but it wasn't that. He found himself unable to move. He was shackled to a bed of some kind. And of course, three small figures walk into the room. This is a classic kind of...
Big black eyes, they're greys. Yeah.
They're greys. Like, it's a classic abduction, but with a weird twist with the men in black. But guess what happens to Charlie? He feels something cold and metallic inserted into his nostrils and then shoved up into his nasal cavity.
I remember they give him some kind of vision as well, don't they?
That's
like
right.
That classic abduction, the future destruction of the planet.
Exactly. They show him gigantic radioactive mushroom clouds dominating everywhere. And then the device is pulled out of his nose and he believes that this device has the ability to insert images into the person's mind. I'm like, well, what have we been talking about with these other implants, you know, able to suppress memories, but also to insert memories.
And Persinger's work with the God helmet.
That's right. And he says then he finds himself back in front of this police car and the same car, the same officers. They're leaning towards him. They've still got these disturbing smiles and they drive away in complete silence and vanish into the darkness. Now, fitting with other people that have experiences with these men in black type characters, the following morning he wakes up, he's feverish, he's cold, he's exhausted. He ends up with a severe chest infection that takes weeks to clear up. You know, and this is like the vampiric kind of psychic vampiric element that comes up with these encounters.
It's just typical of an alien abduction.
It is, right? But guess what? He says, look, there's something else I need to share with you, Nick. There's something that followed up with this, and I think it might have something to do with the clandestine arm of the US military. And of course, you know, we want to know more. Charlie says that it was like, I don't know how long it was after this. It might have been a month or so after that he was lying in his house again and the phone rings multiple times. And every time he answers it or the answering machine answers it, there's just no one on the other end of the line. It's an abrupt hang up. And he finally gets irritated with this constant ringing. So he picks up the phone and says, "Who the hell is this?" And he says, as soon as he does, there's this strange dizzy spell that kind of overcomes him. And he's forced to sit down and then lie down on the couch. And this odd feeling went away, but he falls asleep. He wakes up to find a man in a black military-style outfit with gloved hands firmly over Charlie's mouth. This man was 30-something with a southern accent. He warned him not to say a word. And Charlie is trying to fight this guy off. But two other men, dressed the same in fatigues, spring out from the shadows, grab hold of this guy, inject him with something in his arm, bumble him into a large van where he was surrounded by more men, and he's taken away to some other location. Like he's being driven around. And he said it was weird inside because everything was a blur. But it was like, the van had been configured to be some type of interrogation or something like that, right? And he said, while the men weren't overly threatening, they were very forceful. But this is where it changes, right? And I had this idea that maybe the reason why these MILABs were happening is because it was just the military or a branch of the military were trying to steal the technology. But that doesn't seem to be the case because they start interrogating Charlie.
They start surveying him, right?
They want to know everything about it. They want to know what's going on. They ask him things like, oh, are you a vegetarian? And he's like, no, but I've had strange urges to stop eating meat. The suggestion is, right, these guys, apparently even when they drop him off, they apologize to him.
One of the things they ask him is if he's had any dreams about extraterrestrials.
That's right. That's right. And when Charlie starts giving a depiction
and is he interested in UFOs?
That's right. And when Charlie starts giving them a depiction of what had happened, they get really interested about which city was destroyed, which one was destroyed. Like when they set off these nuclear bombs, where was it? And Charlie's like, look, it was everywhere. I don't know where it was. It was just everywhere. And then he starts just fleetingly mentioning that the aliens inserted something into his nostril. And these men like pricked up their ears. They suddenly got very, very interested and they start telling Charlie what's going on. And Nick says, this is a rare example of frankness and openness in the world of MILABs and abductions.
You think in a moment these hard-nosed black ops guys felt sorry for the kid?
The man explained to Charlie that we have in our midst a dangerous race of extraterrestrials who are routinely implanting devices into large numbers of the American population, devices that have the ability to control us and manipulate us as they see fit. And you know, this is horrifying. It goes down to even claiming that, you know, possible, you know, terrorist attacks and other events like that are being perpetrated by the aliens or by the influence of the alien. And the number of people implanted was growing by the day, and they're very concerned about it. Now, the other man apparently grabbed some type of small device that was like a hairdryer and held it over his face and said, okay, he's clean. So the implant that had been put in was gone, whatever
probably
it
was. Probably was just a hairdryer.
Yeah, probably was. But the idea here is that essentially these devices that are inserted provoke graphic imagery in the minds of the targets. This is what was explained to Charlie. And, you know, the fact that this team felt the need to share such highly classified data with Charlie is very, very odd. But Nick speculates that maybe it was done as a means to get the word out, you know, subtly, you know, as to know what's going on under our noses, you know, literally with these weird implants. So
it's a great story. I remember mentioning it about 5 years ago.
Mm. Yeah.
And being impressed with it then. But hearing you mention it again.
In the this context.
Well, I mean, I'm even more skeptical now, and I'll tell you why. If he's taken physically by these men, right, and they want to know information like, is he a vegetarian? Is he interested in the UFO subject? Has he ever had any dreams about ETs? At least for the first two, how can they not have that information? It's 2015. The guy's online. They already have that information. They know his... Think about big data, right? Think about how trivial it is to figure out what someone buys for their groceries, to figure out what they do online. If they really are part of some beyond black intelligence agency, why would they need to kidnap him, throw him in the back of a car, reveal this information to him in a real physical, unforgettable fashion just to get this kind of information? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, that's a good point. And maybe this is the idea of it being some type of counter-intel asset that they're simply picking up abductees and then feeding them false information. So, and then doing this, you know, this weird kind of thing so that they can keep whatever their actual program is. And this is something that Jack Brewer reported on back in 2009 when he got in contact with Leah Haley. And she just said, because, you know, he asked, he's like, well, what is going on here? She says, look, I just want the mind control and other invasive experiments on unwitting US citizens to be stopped. And maybe that's what it all comes back down to. I mean, maybe all of this and these stories that get into these realms and this world, there is something going on, but it's not some type of ET war. It's not some type of, there's something else, but this is all kind of created to muddy the waters.
We're
none the wiser.
At the very basic foundation, the idea that alien abductions are happening, I think we've established is quite a real possibility.
Mm.
And then to extend that thinking, you would assume that some kind of quasi-government military organization would be aware of it, and they would look into abductees. That's quite
natural
to assume that.
Mm.
But yeah, this kind of
do you know what was
kidnapping people to get information?
But you know what
especially doesn't work in the modern era.
Well, yeah, maybe. But maybe there's something more. Maybe they needed to see if he had the implant in him. But then why wouldn't they just drug him? But maybe that was a genuine element to it. One thing that was said, though, I think it was that...
Yeah, but in that case, I mean, they weren't even aware of it. That's what you assume. They weren't even aware of it until he mentioned it.
Until he mentioned it. Yes, you're right.
So it's almost like they abducted him to ask him if he's a vegetarian.
But
like, what?
They were right. I mean, this is 2015. Apparently, they told him that these ETs try to muddy the water with environmentalism and political strife so that we're distracted.
That's what they told him.
Yeah. So it's like, well, is that where we're at? Look where we're at now. And look what ETs have been doing to contactees for a long time, always warning them about nuclear war and the melting ice caps and the destruction of Earth.
It's concerning if you're a vegetarian. That means that potentially you've been labeled as an ally of the Xenos.
Whatever they are. So I think that I don't think this gives us any actual insight. It just lets you know that these are the stories that are out there. That is what is floating around. But the actual truth may be far more disturbing and far more hidden than we could ever possibly imagine.
Where's the reptilian story?
Oh, play clip 15 for me, Ben.
It's just a footnote.
I've also seen a creature that I call the reptilian. I remember encountering that creature only one time. This creature was the ugliest creature I could ever imagine seeing. He had scaly skin and long claws. His head reminded me of a snake's head. He had long pointed ears. He was probably around 5.5 feet tall, had kind of tan or brownish skin. And it looked like protrusions, sort of, in up here in the chest area.
And I cut it out because I thought it may have been...
He had boobies?
Yes, and I thought it may have been too crass, but he railed her.
Well, it's not too crass.
So, yeah, that's... Well, speaking of being
railed... In the Puff extension coming up, we have pharaohs and an old lady going at it every night of the week. This is pretty clean cut for what's coming up in Plus.
Nice. Good.
Om Seti's Egypt is coming up after this, the story of Dorothy Eady, who, as I mentioned at the start of the show, had that accident when she was a toddler and started remembering these strange past life memories of ancient Egypt and went on to become respected in the archaeological field, whose knowledge of her past life led directly to incredible archaeological discoveries of, real value to history, and even discoveries that extended on way past her death in the 1980s. And in between all these memories, she had visits from the old ghost of a pharaoh. Actually, he wasn't a ghost. He wasn't even a ghost. How could he do like the rogering if he was just a ghost?
Well, there are ghost rogerings, but
he's very, very, very physical, as you're about to find out. Head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus to get in on the story. Sign up today and you get access to the big extensions we do every single Friday on these episodes. And of course, Plus members get an exclusive episode that comes out every single Tuesday as well. More than double the content if you sign up for Plus. Plus members also get a higher quality audio version of the show, a higher bitrate feed. You get a totally ad-free version of the show. And if you sign up for the MU Max tier, you get access to our decade plus worth of back catalog shows as well. Again, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus, $9 a month. Sign up today. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break.
Extension, great to have.